Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this PeopleYouShouldMeet.com teleseminar called How to Reveal the Pure You. My name is Damien Sen, and I will be your host for this evening. In a short moment from now, I'll be introducing our very special guest, the Barefoot Doctor, also known as Stephen Russell. But before I do that, I just wanted to run you through how this call will run this evening. Now, we're going to be on the line for around about an hour, and over the course of the hour, I'll be talking to the Barefoot Doctor, talking to him about the whole idea of being pure and uncovering the pure you. Now, some of the questions that I ask the Barefoot will be my own personal questions, but the vast majority of questions will have actually come in through the website when people were signing up for the call. Now, if this is your first time on a People You Should Meet teleseminar, I do just ask you all to listen very carefully to the questions as they come out, because I might not specifically ask your personal question, but you may actually find that your question is answered in someone else's question. Great. Okay, now, I first came into contact with the Barefoot probably around 2 or 3 years ago when I saw him do a talk down at Alternatives here in London. And the thing that struck me about the Barefoot was just his ability to take ancient wisdom from the Taoist practice and actually translate it into a language or a dialogue that literally the modern day man could understand and actually practically integrate into our lives. Now, the Barefoot has built up a very vast reputation in this personal development arena. He's the author of 12 books, and his most recent book being Pure. And without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the call the Barefoot Doctor. How are you doing there, Barefoot?
I'm very good. Very nice to be welcomed by you.
Now, I thought we'd actually just start at the top, Barefoot. Like I did just mention there that you have recently written a book called Pure. And I was just wondering if you could actually explain exactly what you mean by the word pure.
Well, we have a misconception that to be pure... Well, first let me explain. To have power in your life in any one moment, according to every single spiritual discipline, you have to be pure. You know, the kind of Judaic Christian way of putting it is that to enter the kingdom of heaven, you know, you have to be pure. The Taoists feel exactly the same. To have the power that Taoism is famous for manifesting the reality you want, you have to be pure. However, there's a great misconception about what pure means, because we hold up an ideal of purity, which is that you only eat pure food, you don't eat meat, you don't drink alcohol, you don't take drugs, you don't use any substances that alter your state of mind, including sugar. You only have pure thoughts, you never think a naughty thought, you never think a sexy thought, you never engage in masturbation, and so on and so on and so on. Well, I've asked thousands of people this question: have you actually ever met anybody in real life that you could vouch for that lives exactly like that, has always lived exactly like that for their whole life? And I've not yet encountered anyone. I mean, I've asked this question in Dharamsala around the Dalai Lama's camp and all of that, and nobody has ever actually said yes, they know something. Because so in other words, it's an impossible ideal, and therefore really unattainable. However, what the Taoists consider pure to be is being purely you. And they have a word for this, which is te, which they translates loosely as virtue. It means literally being genuine, being authentic. And that actually has nothing to do with either the dark side of your character or the light side of your character. So we both have potential, have potential for both. It has to do with something that lies behind that, which we could call the witness bearer, that aspect of your psyche that's so deep inside that it's actually beyond the realm of preferences. It observes you whether you're in pain or in the throes of great pleasure, and remains neutral, equanimous, regardless of which end of the scale your local self is experiencing reality. And it's about accessing that part of you that lies deep, deep, deep within the Godhead, if you want to put it in Western terminology, and identifying with that through a series of self-disciplined meditation practices over a period of time, that you gradually become so authentic in everything that you do that even if you're purely bullshitting. You're doing it with such totality of self that it somehow cancels out the dishonesty and makes you be honest anyway. That even if you're being purely deceitful, somehow the purity of you being that deceitful, the fullness of you doing it, will cancel out the deceit. There's some strange inherent mechanism that if you enter into something with the totality of yourself, it seems to cancel out the impurities automatically. And that's really what I'm here to talk about and unpack, hopefully, this evening.
Must admit, that must be a big relief for most of the people on this call, including myself, that literally purity isn't about not making any mistakes or getting everything right, but really doing whatever you can to reveal that pure, authentic self.
Yeah, and I think it's also something to do that when you do make mistakes, which we inevitably all do from time to time, it's to, because you're being purely yourself, you're being authentic, you can sit with the reality that you've made a mistake and not be in denial about it. If you were attempting to reach this ideal of purity, which we're all sort of programmed to do, you'd necessarily have to be in denial about some aspect of yourself that made that mistake. You'd have to be justifying it. Well, it wasn't really that much of a mistake. In fact, it was their fault. It was because of this. It was because of my childhood or whatever. And this is saying to eschew that whole line of thinking and be with the mistake, because it's only a mistake. It doesn't matter. It's just part of the process. But you do it fully and purely, and then you enter the divine moment in that mistake, through that mistake.
That's very powerful.
You'll have to stop me. You'll have to stop me if I'm getting too metaphysical here too quickly.
This evening, Barefoot, I want you to just go for it. Actually, so. Great. So I guess one of the things I was curious about, just in your own life, has the process of finding that pure, authentic self been like an easy process for you or a quick process for you, or has it taken a number of years to arrive at?
Well, I'm 53 and I'm still working on it quite intensively. So I wouldn't say it's been easy. It's been looking back, which I think is something to do with being in the 50s. It enables you to look back a bit more than I've ever noticed before. And I've looked back and it's been a fantastic adventure. I mean, it really has been, you know, supreme, but that's involved. It's swinging out in all directions, and some of them have been quite painful and challenging. Of course they have, yeah.
And so what was it that originally propelled you onto the path?
Well, it started, I think it was irrevocable for me. I do have a strong feeling it was a past life thing. But from the age of about 3, I started tapping out quite complex rhythms and was quite into a sort of shamanistic vibe, naturally, at a very young age. At the age of 6, I spontaneously heard the sound of the Om, the cosmic background radiation wave, very, very deep, below normal human hearing, and I wasn't hallucinating. It was a sort of a familiar sound. It's like, oh, right, that's the sound of the engine room, the universal engine room. Even as a 6-year-old, I kind of instinctively knew what it was, and was always drawn to this kind of the mystical subcurrent that was supporting external reality. And then I got drawn to doing Aikido when I was 11. That was actually because I was the other side of me, paradoxically, was very into fighting. I used to just be a proper tearaway at school. And to calm me down, really, my dad, fortunately, I had a friend who just started learning Aikido with an old Japanese master who was a healer who'd actually come to London to set up a healing practice. And I was sent along to him and was quite awestruck by his personal power and presence, and succumbed to the discipline quite gladly, actually, for the first time in my life. Succumbing to such a strong discipline, and it served me really well, because he, as well as giving me self-discipline through learning the martial art and calming me right down and actually stopping me from being pugnacious, he taught me how to meditate, which as an 11-year-old you don't question it. It doesn't seem like any big deal, but what a fantastic gift to be given at such a young age. And then he also taught how to channel energy through the hands, because he was a healer. And as all great martial art masters say, if you've got learning the power to potentially do damage to somebody, you must also learn the power to heal them as a natural balance. So from the age of 11, I was already stuck in, even without knowing it, in a way. And then I kind of just bumbled and stumbled along, following my fascination, which it was the late 60s. I was a young teenager, and the whole hippie thing I found extremely exotic and colorful and it really drew me. And what drew me about it was that its links with Eastern mysticism and the esoteric practices. That led me to doing yoga. My yoga teacher knew a guy called R.D. Lang, who was then a very famous psychiatrist. And I went to meet him, having read a book of his, which blew my mind. And he agreed at my insistence of taking me on as a sort of an acolyte, more than a student, because I was, you know, it was all quite informal. I was studying how to do psychotherapy, though I never actually wanted to be one. I never had been one. But I wanted to understand that kind of clarity of how you get insight and how you help other people find insight. While I was studying with him, I was also training in Tai Chi. I switched from Aikido to Tai Chi because I saw some guys doing it in the park one day and thought, oh, I know that stuff. I don't know what it is, but I've got to learn it. That must have been a past life memory waking up. And the Tai Chi led me straight into Taoism. I was lucky that, again, because an old guy called Master Chi or Dr. Chi had come to London in the mid-70s and I was studying at his school. So I got a really strong flavor. That somehow propelled me to go and live with the Native Americans, cutting a long story short, in New Mexico in the late 70s. And I stayed there 4 years. So I was exposed to the whole kind of natural shamanistic view of life properly there and the drumming and everything. And at the same time, I studied Chinese medicine with a master of Chinese medicine there as an apprentice. In those days, you could still do that. And then came back to London in 1983, almost like a transformed person. I'd collected all these tools. I could heal people. I was an acupuncturist. So I could teach Tai Chi. And I don't think this could have happened any other way than taking myself right out of it all and then coming back again. And that's how it all began. But it wasn't like a career. I wasn't chasing a career, because in those days, this stuff wasn't really, it wasn't viable as a career. I remember when I came back from America in 83 and people said, well, how are you going to earn a living? I said, well, I'm a qualified acupuncturist now. I said, well, how are you going to earn money out of that? You know, it was quite interesting. So it wasn't a career move. It was really just because I was so deeply fascinated by it all that I didn't seem to have any choice. And that was my priority. And life seemed to more or less took care of me as I went along. And may long continue to do so, because I still remain a bumbling fool, just constantly following my fascination rather than rhyme or reason, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's a phenomenal pedigree in terms of examining and exploring all the different modalities within the personal development arena. You've definitely got a very unique history of actually exploring all these different disciplines. But
yeah.
The one thing that really interested me that you just said there, barefoot, was just the fact that you said you didn't seem to have a choice. Now, do you actually believe that that place in life means that you're purely on your soul's path when you feel that this is the only compelling thing that you're here to do?
I guess it must be. I mean, I hesitate to talk about it too glibly because I realise even as I'm speaking that on some level I must be quite privileged to have been shunted into this position. Because there has never been a doubt about it. And I guess, yes, that would mean that I'm on my soul's path. It's not without its price. I mean, you know, there's still a lot of self-examination goes on, and at times when it's not going well, because, you know, literally you are just following your instinct the whole time. So there are times you're going to lead yourself down blind alleys. I mean, there's a lot of self-examination then about, you know, how come I'm such an idiot? You know, that goes on a lot as well. It's not all like, yeah, I'm cool and everything's fine all the time, you know.
Brilliant. Now, say for someone who is sitting at home listening to this call, really feeling that urge to move more deeply into their soul's path, what are some easy places to get started, I guess, on that journey?
Well, I have to say really the most important thing is, in a way, the most general part of it, or the least specific, which is that you have to develop a relationship with that part of yourself that I was talking about before, which we could call the pure you, but which initially, at least, is easier sometimes to grasp hold of when you consider it to be this you inside is actually a universal you. I mean, we call it God in the West, but that's a bit of a limiting concept because we've misused the words for so long. But the Tao, the ineffable, the invisible presence, the ubiquitous presence, the consciousness that informs the reality at a subatomic level, whether you believe in it or not is actually immaterial. It's just being willing, from the point of view of like an existential experiment, to entertain even just the possibility that there is this, for want of a better word, divine presence informing, generating, connecting all known phenomena throughout existence. And to somehow make contact with that, create a dialogue with it. When I lived in New Mexico, you know, I'd been into this stuff for a long time, but was struggling a lot with the kind of so-called spiritual aspects of it. And my friend Sonny Spruce, who's the, you know, the dancer in the tribe that I hang out with all the time I was there, he says to me, well, he looked at me one day, and, you know, I was doing the Tai Chi in front of him and everything, and, you know, playing with the chi. He said, you know what the trouble with you is? And I said, well, I can think of about 300 things. Which is it today? And he said, you don't know how to pray. And I went immediately into, our Father who art. I said, no, you're right. I don't, actually. I really don't know how to pray. What do you mean, anyway? He says, you have to talk to the presence. You have to talk to the Great Spirit all the time in everything and everywhere. Look at the mountain. Walk towards the mountain every day for 10 minutes and talk to the mountain. So what do you mean talk to the mountain? I mean, what's the point of that? He said, talk to the mountain. Just walk towards it every day for 10 minutes and talk to it. And then we'll talk again about it in a few weeks. So I started doing that and feeling really stupid, actually, walking along this road talking to a mountain. After a few days of it, there was this strange sense that in spite of myself and my rational mind, the mountain was actually talking back to me. And wow. It's something to do with being available to this cosmic intelligence that is evidently informing everything, including us. And then entering into a dialogue with it, even on a quite childlike level, you know, like you would talk to your mother or your father. For me, it's a bit of a mother. It's a maternal force that I talk to. So really, we're talking about praying, actually. But I don't like to use that word because it does have so many strange connotations. It's just entering into a dialogue with your higher self, with the unseen presence. Even if you don't believe it's true on some level, that doesn't matter. You just do it as an experiment. And that then starts opening you to this deeper level of self, which is responding to that, and that's where the real guidance is coming from. You don't have to change anything externally initially. I don't think you have to go about thinking so much, oh, what is it I want to do? I need to change my life. I need to change the way I work. I need to change it. Yeah, I mean, all that's valid and everything, but it's best to start at the core of it all and get the dialogue going with the higher self, so that, because in that dialogue you can refine what your intention actually is. What is it you really are wanting to manifest while you're alive this time? And then once you clear on that, somehow the rest of it, the details, start to fall into place on their own. Of course, you have to work at it. You have to do stuff. But it will guide you as to what to do.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Actually, just reminded me of actually going to see a shaman speak. And in a talk that he was talking about the whole notion of prayer as well. And he was just talking about the way they went about praying in his culture. And I think up until the time, the only real sort of reference point I had for praying was the traditional Christian reference point of getting down on your knees and just hoping for something to come about. But the way this shaman actually demonstrated the way that he prayed, it was literally like he was upright on his feet and he was chanting and really in this incredible, powerful posture, and really, I guess, exactly what you said there, just opening up that connection to a divine source. And I just left that space just feeling so invigorated and so alive, and that energy really just rushed through me. So it was just nice to see a different reference point, but I guess at the essence, really opening that connection, which is exactly what you said there.
Yeah, and one of the things that I noticed that hanging around the Native Americans, and also I think that the Chinese Taoists that I've met as well, is that when in dialogue with this divine unseen presence, there's no looking upwards. They don't look up. They look on the level. Their eyes are actually going out straight ahead of them, because it's not as if that this presence is any more in the sky than it is on the ground. It's everywhere, within everything and everyone. And so there's this kind of, I think, a slightly more evolved level of spirituality is facilitated when you actually physically keep your eyes on the level, your view, your gaze is out on the level rather than upwards. Because the upwards bit, when we look up to the divinity that we're assuming is in the sky, up in the clouds, which is patently stupid. I mean, it's no more so there than it is anywhere else, and it's as much there as anywhere else. But when you look up, it implies that it is bigger, better, and more amazing than you are, that you are somehow a nothing, you know, that which goes along with that whole idea of original sin and the kind of innate shame that we all generally suffer from, this low self-esteem thing that everybody seems to carry with them as their burden. Whereas actually, I think an evolved level of spirituality is where you accept that you are nothing short of a total miracle, because you're a manifestation of the divine force, of this, whatever you want to call it, this universal intelligence. And as such, are magnificent. You're part of that. And to actually assume that you're anything less than the miraculous is in some way actually arrogant. Because it's like saying that you are separate from it. You know, you are something separate that could be judged, but you're not. We're not. We are actually all totally a manifestation of this. We, God is this, if you like. The Tao is everything we see around us. The world is the Tao, and we are part of the world. We are part of that Tao.
I do like that, the whole notion that we are divine beings just wandering around planet, just meeting other gods and having conversations with other gods, and whether they're in the physical form or the non-physical, it's just such a as a thought form, just like a really inspiring way to live.
Well, I find it so. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not always in this state. I don't know many people that are constantly in it, because we get distracted by externals, you know, and you know, the things that glitter in the world around us draw our attention. But then what happens is the more centered you are through meditation practice, the more quickly you become aware that you're being distracted. And so you notice it makes you feel a bit uncomfortable in your body after a while, because it feels really enticing. You know, you get drawn to a beautiful looking person or a beautiful looking object or a situation that really looks appealing. I mean, it feels really, really real that's what you should go for. But what happens is, after a while of your attention being drawn outwards, you become physically constricted and uncomfortable, stressed and anxious. And so you learn to draw yourself back into what I call the pure state within. And that refreshes you again. That puts you back in touch with the divine presence in everything. And I think that's what I wanted to come on to next, if that's all right with you, or if it's in line with your questions, is like, how do you actually do this? What's because it's all well and good talking all this stuff out, and I think really, really important, hopefully inspiring to everyone who's listening. But what I relish about the Taoist system is that it actually provides very practical, pragmatic, physical tools for actually engendering that awareness. Would you like me to go on?
Yeah, keep going.
The thing is, you see, so rather than referencing your moment-by-moment experience and your overall view of reality to the thoughts in your head, the training is to learn to reference it to what's going on in your body instead. So your body becomes the kind of arena or field in which you experience being alive in all respects. And to enable this to happen, the body firstly has to be relaxed. I mean, what I'm going to say now is essentially all the principles that go with the Chinese Taoist martial arts, Tai Chi being the most famous, and which are then practiced in sitting meditation. But the idea of it is that you learn to do this sitting still, because it's easier that way. And then you train yourself to do it as much as you can remember while you're walking around, while you're talking to people, while you're watching a movie, whatever you're doing, you train yourself to do it from this state, because then you're in a state of constant meditation, more or less, and therefore able to feel this divine presence we're talking about, and from that get your power to kind of shape reality in the way that you want it to be. And it starts off with relaxing the body, and that means becoming aware of all your muscles and sinews, and noticing how you're gripping on with them, hitherto unconsciously, as a sort of fear reaction to being alive. Because we have to state quite clearly that when you're born, coming out of the womb and being kind of snapped into the outside world reality is a shock to the system, which I think we never actually recover from. I think, you know, we learn to deal with it and compensate for it, but on some level, the switch from being in the womb to being outside and breathing in the air is a shock that we never really quite get over. So we live in a state of fear, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of the survival mechanism. But if we don't process that fear consciously, it lodges as tension and gripping in the muscles of the body. So the first step is to actually consciously relax wherever you're gripping on. And most people grip on in the buttocks. That's to sort of hold your shit together. In the back of the neck, because that's where we control reality from, by turning our head this way or that, and that's how we see what we want and we go for it. The chest, because we're afraid of emotional pain, because from the first few times it happened, it hurts so much, we don't want it to happen again. So we close up the chest to stop that happening, although it doesn't work. And then most importantly, the breathing area, the solar plexus, the diaphragm region, we tense that up and hold our breath as a way of almost holding life back to stop it kind of moving forwards in case it hurts us again, you know. So so it's a thing of softening all the muscles, the face as well. I forgot to mention the face. We face the world with our face, so the face tenses up a lot. Very good to let the face go and all the expression on the face drain away, so you're not holding your face in any particular shape. And that releases energy into the body, which you then stimulate by letting the breath flow freely. When the breath flows freely, you can be at one with the fear in you, the natural existential fear, and it stops actually becoming a frightening thing. As soon as fear stops being frightening, it's not really fear anymore, it's just an energy. And the only thing that makes fear is that we fear it. You know, we were afraid of feeling the fear. But when you allow fear, which is the natural human state, to flow through you, it transforms naturally into energy. Once you've completely and utterly relaxed your body, and I say completely and utterly, that's nonsense really, because you know, however much you relax it, there'll always be more you can relax. But relatively speaking, in the moment, if right now you're listening to this, you can just let go of all the tension in your body and you're breathing freely. The next stage is to kind of arrange your bones properly to give you kind of maximum expansion of the mainframe, because the bigger you feel in your body, the bigger your consciousness is. And the way you do that is you imagine that someone is suspending the crown of your head by an invisible thread upwards towards the ceiling, and that has the effect of lengthening your spinal column. Well, this of course is good for all the nervous system, which makes you feel better and physically and mentally, but it also encourages the flow of energy up the rear of the spine. And the next thing is you allow your shoulders to broaden, because without realizing it, we're pulling the shoulder blades together to kind of narrow ourselves so we don't take up too much space. But actually, it's better to let the shoulders drop and broaden, because that opens up the thoracic cavity, which enables you to breathe better, gives your heart more room to pump, and everything works better. You also do the same with your hips and buttocks. We tend to hold the hips tight, maybe to make ourselves look slimmer or whatever, but it's better to just let, especially when sitting down, to let the buttocks spread in the chair, to let the sit bones spread. So you're actually literally taking up more width. So this way, expanding across the shoulder girdle and across the pelvic girdle, and at the same time lengthening up the spine, you're affording yourself maximum internal space on a physical level. Are you with me so far? Is everything kind of clear?
I'm actually just going through everything. Yeah, you're doing it. The way with you, actually feeling
fantastic.
Quite a big change in my physiology and my state of being.
Fantastic. Well, the next thing is that you've got where you're looking at the reality from. The place we habitually observe reality from is the front of the brain, the prefrontal lobes. And so we've got our eyeballs, and above them we've got this whole conversation going on. A commentary about local reality, or it's dangerous here, or it's safe here, or those people like me, or they don't like me, or I like them, or I don't like them, or I'm doing well, or I'm not doing well, I should have done this, I could do that. All the sort of internal dialogue that we continually indulge in occurs in the front of the brain. And that's all well and good, but it distracts you from the pure state. So the technique, because you can't turn that off, people talk about meditating and calming the mind, they say, that you just, you know, stop thinking. Let your thoughts go. Well, it's really, really hard to do that, because the mind is there to think with. That's what it does. And if it stops thinking, it freaks out because it doesn't know who it is if it doesn't have a thought going on. So rather than trying to stop the mind from thinking, you just literally click the program shut, the window shut, by drawing the point from which you're observing everything backwards into the midbrain region between the ears. So it's like, as you're sitting here now, your eyes become like two windows in the front of the skull, but you are looking from way deeper back inside in the midbrain, from the midbrain, rather. And the ancient Taoists called this the cave of the original spirit, the immortal self, the witness bearer, the divine self. its eyes are located in the very center of your brain. And at first, it might seem a bit alien, because like I said, if I said you feel the inside of your wrist, it takes a bit of practice to actually feel the inside of your wrist, even though it's your wrist. It's just because the mind's not used to tracking that way. But it's one of those things. So there was a story I read once about a boy who was listening to the corn grow. It's this, you know, he kept listening every night and he couldn't hear it. And one night he heard the corn growing and he got it. And it's like that. You have to kind of try and feel the center of your brain from within. And then after a few days of trying it and it not making any sense, suddenly you can feel it, because you really can feel it all the time, because it's your brain, you know, why wouldn't you be able to feel it? So this takes a little bit of practice, but once you get it, once you get the sensation of something physical almost in the center of the brain, and that's your point, that's your observation point, that's where you're looking from, that immediately shifts your whole relationship with external reality. You feel as if you're connecting to it from far deeper within. At first, it actually can be a bit scary because you feel really powerful with it. It makes you feel quite powerful, and suddenly there are no thoughts going on in the front of the brain because you've gone behind them. You've literally bypassed them, and you immediately have the vision of a divine being, and that actually is a bit scary at first. So the next stage, once you've got that a bit familiar, is to concentrate on your chest, because by relaxing the center of the chest and making it feel warm, it's quite good to put your hand there actually and just kind of rub it a little bit softly, round and round. It allows your innate human warmth, your natural propensity for caring and loving life, yourself, other people, to flow more freely. And as soon as that basic human warmth starts flowing freely from the chest, the whole experience of being this powerful divine being becomes a much more loving, warm, kindly experience. It's a nurturing sensation. So your connection with external reality, rather than it being a sort of slightly cold spiritual stroke intellectual notion, becomes this really warm, loving connection, as if you're cuddling your mother or your child or your loved one. As when you sit with reality, it's as if you're embracing it all and loving it all. And this is very, very important, because it's this kind of disposition, this loving disposition, which somehow, and I don't really know why, but I think we all know instinctively why, draws good fortune to you, so to speak. It draws the blessings, the goodwill of other people towards you, because they feel happy around you. They feel happy when they think about you, even, because energy transmits via thought as well. You don't have to be present, as you know. So now what we've got here is this kind of divine power, this vision rather, from the center of the brain. You've got this lovely warm feeling developing from the center of the chest. It just makes you want to nurture those around you, help them, and allow them to help you too, that brotherly, sisterly, unconditional love. And then supporting all that is your will and your power. Because without will and power, willpower, you tend to be flimsy. You know, however loving and divinely awake you are, without it being anchored to something solid with a lot of energy running through it, there's a risk it could just be a bit theoretical. And people could take advantage of you, could get blown here and there by the wind. So the last thing that they talk about, not the last thing, but the last part of this section of information is the idea that you allow your sense of physicality, your physical being, to be gathered around your navel region. A reason for this is, as a martial artist, if you stood up and you stretch your hands above your head so that you're basically in the most extended position possible, you'll notice that your navel is bang in the middle between your feet and your outstretched hands above your head. And therefore, it's considered to be your center. It's like as if you were a suitcase and I had to pick you up by attaching a handle to you somewhere. I'd attach it to your navel or lower back region in the same area to lift you, because that's where your fulcrum would be. And so you allow your sense of physicality to be gathered around your navel. And how you do that, it's another one of those things. Like in Aikido, they talk about think about the one point. They mean that point there. They just think about that point. And that takes a little bit of practice too, maybe a few weeks of contemplating this point. And it doesn't make much sense. Like, what do you mean think about a point? But bit by bit, by doing it, the mind starts to gather itself there. It starts to organize itself around that point on the physical level. And once that happens, you feel powerful as you walk down a street. You feel powerful as you sit. You just feel strong, physically strong, because of it, because you're organized now rather than just all disparate and scattered. You know, when your body moves, it moves as a single unit, and that encourages your mind to move as a single unit so you can focus on what you want more clearly. So I think in a nutshell, probably we everyone needs to take a momentary breather to accommodate all that rush of information. I know I do. How are we doing so far?
That was absolutely brilliant. And for people on the call who would like to listen to that process again, because it just delivered so much information there, please rest assured that we are recording this call, so you will be able to re-explore that step-by-step process. But I guess for me, Beth, the one thing that I really took away from that, having, I guess, done a lot of spiritual practice in the last few years, the one thing that really jumped out at me was just the notion of just relaxing the chest and just really opening the heart. Like, just when you were saying that, I just felt in my own body just a whole opening and expansiveness just erupt inside of me. So, yeah, that was really, really powerful. And it's not something that I hear a lot of in, I suppose, the personal development arena, but I thought that was personally very powerful.
Oh, thank you for saying. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? The love thing is quite a... I mean, when you say to people, be loving, you know, let love be the lubricant that makes your life go round smoothly. Everyone responds to it immediately. People always respond, and you can see their spirits lifting up momentarily, but we don't really know what it means a lot of the time, because it doesn't mean being nice to people necessarily. It doesn't mean being sweet. It can do, but it's not necessarily, it doesn't mean you have to do anything or hug people or do anything particular about it. It's just a kind of quality of openness with warmth flowing from it. And I think, looking back on my whole life, I did a retreat at the Hill That Breathes in Italy with John Parkin's place a few weeks ago, and I was teaching this state of pure. And I noticed that because it was a beautiful place in Italy, and the air was perfumed and fireflies at night and lovely people, and it was all in a big geodesic dome, it was in a forest, and it was, you know, a really pretty ideal setting. I noticed myself becoming progressively more and more loving with this group. I mean, more caring about them all, and as got them all to become more authentic, less pretending and more real. People started opening up and revealing their pain and their passion and all the rest of it. That it was that quality of lovingness that I felt coming from my chest and from all of them, because this is the sort of stuff we were discussing, that's what gave it value. And when we all said goodbye to each other at the end of the week, there was genuine, in that moment, huge universal, you know, unconditional love flying between everybody, a great sense of caring for each other. And in that state, all the considerations that we tend to get lost in, you know, the fear of what's going on in the world and, you know, will I make a living and am I going to mess it up and what happens if we run out of food and all of that stuff, actually, strangely, becomes secondary, because you just know that with this love and with enough people around feeling it together, that somehow we will actually get through and continue to, I pray, manifest a world of plenty and peace for everybody. This love is really the most crucial element of it all. So if it can all be just as simple as relaxing the chest, which I believe it can, I mean, what a great gift.
That's amazing. Thanks very much for sharing that.
Pleasure.
Now, I'm just going to drop into a couple of questions that came in through the site, Barefoot. Mm. And the question I'm going to start you with is a question from Marta, who's in the United Kingdom. And this question is just to do with resistance. And Marta asks, what to do with all the unconscious resistance rebellion to reveal the pure you, which feels very connected to the common unconscious? So I guess for anyone who's on that path of revealing their pure self and they're up against resistance, what are a tip to sort of work with that?
Well, I think that you have to, hello Marta, I think you have to honour and respect that resistance, because it's a sign of your innate strength. There are two fundamental qualities to the mind and to everything in existence, really. There's the quality of stasis, everything that aspect of the mind that wants to keep everything remaining the same so that it can make sense of it all and organize it and create structures out of it that will last and be meaningful. And then there's that quality of and tendency of the mind towards dynamism, the urge to change everything, to make progress, to improve everything. Now, both are essential for a complete rounded picture, and the more balanced the two are, the more satisfying and fulfilling your life will be. And you have to have enough of the static quality to keep things in shape and organized just enough that they don't all fall apart. And you have to have enough of the dynamic quality, that urge to progress and improve things, to stop the static stultifying and becoming congealed, therefore, you know, turning you into an active blob. And it's something to do with balancing those two sides. Now, resistance is naturally an attribute of the static aspect of mind, that which doesn't want anything to change. So it resists the new, and it will resist every bit of new information going. You know, you wake up in the morning and it's a beautiful day, and the dynamic quality goes, oh yeah, it's another beautiful day, I can't wait to get up. And the static quality goes, no, not another day, I want to go back to sleep, the sun's shining too bright, let me go back to sleep. And those two are always working together, and it's not a matter of overcoming the resistance. You know, oh, look, shut up, it's a beautiful day, we're going to get up and do it anyway. It's not about that. It's about stepping back behind both of them and going, oh, there's my side that wants to enjoy the day, like, a, you know, the dynamic aspect. Bless that side of me. Oh, and there's that side of me that resists it and wants to stay in bed. Oh, bless that side of me too. Thank you, both of you. Well, look, together, we're going to get up today because that's what we have to do. You know, that's all there is to it. I'm going to lie in bed. If you want to lie in bed all day, you can, and there are consequences. So there's, but you know that there's this intention to move through the day and make the most of it. That comes from your pure self behind both the resistance and the urge to make progress. So I think that honoring the resistance and loving it, loving that aspect of you that wants to resist with compassion, but taking it with you, so you carry it with you, and you don't try and get rid of it. You feel it in your body again, so you bring it back to the body, and generally you'll find that somewhere in the upper abdominal area, either on the left side around the spleen or the right side around the liver. Generally, for some reason, women generally feel it on the left side around the spleen area, and men generally feel it on the right side around the liver area, but of course there are many exceptions to that. And by feeling the resistance in your body, locating it somewhere in your abdominal region, and then using your mind to let that relax, to let that go, you'll notice it's relaxing you throughout your body, throughout wherever the muscles are resisting. Because that gripping I was talking about before, that is the resistance to the new. And by releasing it with your mind, softening it, letting it go, that within maybe minutes, maybe hours, maybe a couple of days, depending on your makeup and time of the day, time of the year, how tense you are, you'll find that not only your muscles will start softening, but your mind will too. So you'll feel yourself less resistant to doing things. There'll still be that voice there. It has to be there. You have to love that voice that says, no, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this. But you carry on bit by bit anyway, not expecting mega miracles with every session of meditation, say, but just knowing that cumulatively you're gradually building up bit by bit. And then every now and again you'll have one of these big exponential jumps of awareness, and you'll realize that having practiced every day a little bit, and I'd suggest no more than, say, 4 minutes a day, really, for busy people, it's enough. Just a little bit every day, as long as it's every day, you'll look back over a period of months and suddenly realize, wow, you know, I thought I was doing it incrementally, but I've actually made a huge quantum leap in my awareness and personal power levels.
That's brilliant. Like, in my coaching work, barefoot, that's something that I'm often asking people about resistance, and that was actually one of the best responses that I've heard. And I love the idea of just noticing the two aspects of self and just honoring both parts and coming to some sort of mediation where you can engage all of you to come and show up in the world. I thought that's a phenomenal answer. And
as you're saying I cut over you, forgive me for that. As you were saying that, it made me kind of see something that I haven't actually given voice to before, but I've felt for a long time. This, it's as if the resistant part of you and the progressive part of you are like two children that are your children that you love with all your heart, and you, the watcher, the witness bearer, the adult, the parent, It's almost like that. I wouldn't want to limit it to that, but it's like you're the loving parent, and it's the way that you'd be with a child that you really love. You'd want to protect it. You want to love it. You want to bring it with you. You want to let it develop on its own. You don't want to cramp its style or cramp its spirit, but nor do you want to let its lack of experience guide you. You have to be the one that's guiding it, but you do it really lovingly, and it's like, come on, come on. I love you. Come on. I know you're resisting, and that's fine, but come on, come on. Let's go. Let's go. And if it says no, you go, no, I'm serious now. We're going to go. Like you would with your own child, you know.
Yeah. That's brilliant. Yeah. Great. Now, this next question, on fear, and we touched on fear just briefly earlier on when you were just talking about our entry into this world. It can, just by being born, conjure up fear in people, and it's a fear that almost never resides. And I've got a question from Veronica in the UK as well. And she wanted to know how she can actually reveal the pure me and be comfortable with it without the fear of being hurt. Do you have some tips for Veronica?
Yeah, I think that there's a bit of a misconception about what it means to reveal the pure you. Because when you are in a state of purity, as I defined it before, when you're in a state of authenticity and you're situated properly within your body, so you're like we were doing just before, you're deep within yourself, the pure you, the virtuous you, reveals itself. You don't have to do anything about that. But the layers of protection, that the sort of social protection that have been constructed over the years to help you manage the protocol of communication between you and other people, they remain the same. They don't really change that much, and it doesn't matter. It's as if you had a group of enlightened lamas meeting, and I've seen this happen. You get a group of enlightened Tibetan lamas meeting up in a room, because they're enlightened doesn't mean they don't have manners and follow a certain protocol in their communication. So there'd still be this momentary awkwardness of like, hello, how are you? Oh, I've been very well, I haven't seen you around lately. And there'll still be small talk. There'll still be those kind of social barriers and layers that have to be got through. But they'll drop them faster and then, to reveal the spirit-to-spirit level of communication. So in other words, when you are embarking on this path or progressing along this path of becoming more and more authentic, more at one with yourself, it doesn't mean that you have to do anything differently socially. You don't have to reveal anything. You can carry on being as awkward and complex and shy or confident and outgoing as you want. It doesn't really make any difference. Your outer clothing, in other words, which metaphorically means your layers of defenses, social defenses, and the games you play to keep people at various distances, they remain in place. I mean, you might refine them as you go along and they become a bit smoother operated, but they need to be, because that's local level, local plane stuff. But what happens is that regardless of that, in spite of that, the spirit or the deeper pure self naturally starts communicating with the spirit within everybody else, so that the social stuff falls away more freely. There's a guy I know that I like to hang out with occasionally. He's a professional man who has no apparent insight whatsoever. He's a lovely, 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 lovely guy, a real family man. His job is, I'm not going to say his job because just in case anybody might for some bizarre reason connect to who I'm talking about. It's a pretty dull job, but it earns him lots of money. He's a really responsible guy. His mind seems to be completely focused on externals, like the game of cricket last week and who bowled who and, the beer that they serve in this pub and nice food they're having and talking about his work. There's no interest to talk about anything deeper whatsoever. Yet because he's such a lovely, lovely man, when I'm around him and I'm in my spirit, he seems to be in his as well. In fact, you can feel it by the way he smiles, the way he talks, and you walk away from the end of an evening of talking absolute rubbish about complete small talk, feeling utterly nurtured. And in other words, it doesn't have to be even spoke about. It doesn't have to be defined, or you don't have to act in a spiritual way or become look like you're enlightened even. Sometimes the most, in fact, one of my father-in-laws, my ex-father-in-law, I'm very, very, very close to, guy of 85, he used to be in the RAF, real old English gent, and we have conversations about, and he's a master of being able to talk about anything, the colour of a doorway, and talk about it for half an hour in such a riveting, engaging way, in this beautiful voice. That you don't care what he's talking about. You're just using the words to make sound for each other, to make it feel nice, to be with each other. But the real transmission of love is really occurring. So I'd say to Veronica that really, if you just stay with the internal positioning and you allow your love to flow to whomever you're with, that in itself reveals the spirit to everybody present without it even needing to be discussed or even acknowledged in any way at all. And the miracles, the sort of quantum shifts between you, will occur of themselves.
Brilliant. That's an excellent answer. Now, Beth, we just have time for one more quick question. And
yes.
This one's actually come from Donna in South Africa. And Donna asks, it's a personal question, and she was just wondering, what tools do you use to support you in consistently living the pure you?
I mean, I use all this that I'm talking about. This is like, if you want to call this a tool, this would be my number one tool, because this is at the crux of all of it. And I'd like to remind everyone that I started off by talking about being in an active dialogue with the divine presence, the Tao, whatever you want to call it, as the most important bit of the tool. The rest of it becomes more detailed, you know, it's just details after that. But then this idea of referencing myself to my body. But I also make sure to practice. I do four Chinese Taoist martial arts, and each of them has a dance. It's like a form that you do solo, shadow boxing. And I make sure that I practice at least three of them, if not all four, every single day, even if only just for the minimum amount of time. And I do a set of Taoist floor exercises that are very similar to Hatha yoga. And at the end of that, I sit and meditate with my eyes closed for, you know, sometimes if I've got no time, for as long as it is, if I've got 2 minutes, that's all I'll do it for. But if I've got 20 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, I'll sit like that. And I make sure that I do that every single day, because even some days you're just going through the motions. You don't get a lot out of it initially, but you do it every day. And often you get a fantastic day, quite by surprise, and you really have a great practice. And that sets you up for the rest of the day somehow. And also I do believe a lot in writing down affirmations with a pencil on a pad of A4, which I keep by my bed. And when I get into bed at night, I try and think of everything I'm afraid of, and I turn that into an affirmation so that, like, you know, if I'm feeling afraid, I'm going to mess everything up. It's like, even though I have this fear I'm going to mess everything up, my choice is to succeed in a beautiful way with everything I'm doing this week. Or I've got a hell of a workload on and I think, oh, I can't get through that. Jesus, it's too much. I'll go like, you know, this week I choose to get everything done easily, effortlessly and miraculously and enjoy every moment of it. And by writing these things down, I don't know why, by pencil, I think it's because it reminds you when you're, you know, brings out the child. It does seem to, you know, you finish writing it, you're tired, you go to sleep, you don't think about it again, and you notice by the end of the week that you have actually achieved everything you wanted to easily and effortlessly. It seems to be a great way of disciplining the unconscious level of mind. So I strongly recommend writing affirmations down as well.
That's great. I think just acknowledging something takes away the power of it. And if it is fear that you're experiencing, just being with it and writing it down, that very process can actually take the legs out of it.
Well, yeah, because it sort of gives you a bit of psychological distance from it, doesn't it? You stop identifying with the problem so much, yeah.
Yeah, I did like the little tip of the grey-lead pencil. I think that's a good one as well.
Yeah, and it's nice sharpening them as well. It's a lovely feeling when you sharpen a pencil. So you have to buy a pencil sharpener too.
Brilliant. Excellent. Now, Beth, we're coming up to the end of the hour, and I know that you've just delivered so much value on this call today, and I've certainly felt that I've grown as a human being over the last hour, and I'm sure that people on the phone are feeling the same way. And they'll definitely be curious about how to actually continue their learning journey with you. And I was just wondering if you could share how people can find out more about the work you do and how they can follow more of your practices.
Well, thank you. I mean, for me, the most important project of all of them for me is actually my website, barefoot.global or barefoot.world.com. And I try. I'm constantly working on organizing it better and better as I go along. But what I try and do is give as much information, too much probably, every single day as I possibly can to describe and explain how all this stuff works. From a kind of, almost like sharing my own process with everybody. And I write a couple of columns, sometimes three columns a day, and I do video pods and audio meditation pods and live meditations in the chat room in there, and I do email coaching to help people through specifically. You have to be a member of the site to get all this stuff, but that's what it's there for. So I kind of, it's like my online school and healing practice in a way. That's my main thing. So I that's where I'd encourage everybody to come to. And, you know, the books like Pure, is, I think it's a beautiful book myself and very well worth it. And there's a meditation DVD out available through Nightingale Conan, which again explains all this stuff well. And there are the occasional events, or quite often frequent events and what have you. But and I make music as well that encourages this state of mind. I mean, I've been doing that for 30 years, which is also available on the site. But like I said, I think it's really the site. If I was going to direct anyone anywhere, that would be where I can have my dialogue with you wherever I am or wherever you are in the world. And I will honestly do my very utmost to share all this stuff as generously as possible so that you get it. And I do get people do get it. That's the beautiful thing.
I have listened to a few of your samples of music, and I'm just wondering if you could share with people where your inspiration comes for your music.
Wow. Well, it comes a lot from the Native American shamanistic thing. It comes a lot from the Brazilian side of things. So my dad was a jazz drummer, and my cousin was Stan Getz. So I've got quite a heritage in that kind of Brazilian side of things. And then growing up, the Pink Floyd were huge for me in my early teens because they were, you know, they took what Stockhausen did into the realm of rock and, you know, really experimented with sound for the sake of sound. The Beatles, of course, and the whole rhythm and blues and soul movement and blues itself and quite a lot of classical composers. Vaughan Williams, for example, you know, tonal poems and the later tonal poems of Beethoven's quartets and quintets and, I could go on, and then the whole kind of modern dance movement, which is where I'm really kind of part of, you know, that came out of the 80s, and, you know, there's some incredible music being made, electronic music being made these days. I mean, myself, I try to, well, I do blend, organically played, because I'm a musician, I play guitars and keyboards and bass guitar and all the rest, you know, I blend organically played music with electronic signals, so you get this quite interesting, you know, harmonic effect, and I work with frequencies and, because from that very first om that I heard, I've always been trying to recreate the power of that. So that's why I'm so hooked on the sound thing. And each piece is about 20, well, up between 16 and 20 minutes long. So each one is long enough to take you through a proper meditation journey. Some of them's more suited for dancing to, some for sitting to.
Brilliant. Excellent. Well, we're at the end of the call, Beth. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to acknowledge you for basically following your bliss over the last 30 or so years and really digging in and exploring this fertile knowledge base and also just taking the time to not only just learn and study all these different disciplines but also to deliver them in a form that is very, very accessible for people. I think one of your real geniuses is literally translating something that does seem complex for so many people and putting it in a language that everyone can understand. So I just wanted to acknowledge you for that and also to thank you for giving of your time so freely this evening.
Oh, thank you. And I want to thank you for being such an absolutely gracious, gracious interviewer. It was a pure, pure delight doing this. Thank you, really.
Thanks, Barefoot. And I was just wondering, just in finishing, do you have any final words of advice for people on that journey of revealing the pure you?
You throw me that curveball right at the end there. I'd say really if you had to just take one thing away from this, it would be stop holding your breath and breathe freely. No matter what you're feeling, breathe freely and do everything you're doing with the fullness of yourself. Don't hold back. Trust life. Jump. It will catch you. The more you jump, the more it will catch you. Life is the most beautiful, beautiful adventure, and the more you jump into it and let it catch you, in spite of all your fear, the more purely you will feel the delight of every moment. And the more purely you feel the delight, the more pure you are, the more wonderful the benefits and results of everything you do.
Awesome. Thanks, Stephen. That's brilliant. Okay, everyone on the call, this call recording will be made available freely tomorrow on the peopleyoushouldmeet.com website. So in particular, we went through the process of just enabling yourself to reconnect with a pure you, and it's a very, very powerful process. I'm personally going to sit with it and probably listen to this recording multiple times myself, so it is freely available for you. Please feel free to share it with friends who may find some benefit from it as well. And Yeah, well, I just wanted to also just take the time to thank everyone for sending in their questions yet again. Some amazing questions in there, and it certainly does help me bring a real richness to these calls as well. So, yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge you all for listening, and I look forward to having you all on a People You Should Meet call very soon. And thanks once again, Barefoot.
Oh, real pleasure. Thank you too.
Okay. Take care, everyone.
All right. Yeah.